was really worried no one would show up, so this is great. They locked the doors until about 8 o'clock, and so it's just empty in here and quiet in this big, scary room. My name is Alistair Spears. I'm a senior operations PM in the office deployment team. This session is the Cloud Ready Desktop, Windows 10 and Office 2016. Before we get started, just show of hands. I tried my best at the most kind of clickbait title imaginable in this session. So who's here because I mentioned cloud in the title? Anyone? Couple? Okay. Desktop? Okay. Windows? Yeah. Office? Okay, great. Well, hopefully we'll cover all of those things as we get into it as well. A bit about me. I grew up in Brisbane, actually. I moved to Sydney with Microsoft many years ago now, back in 2007. And then in 2010, moved over to Seattle in Redmond. Redmond's a suburb in the outskirts of Seattle. It's where Microsoft is based. It is probably the weirdest job I've ever had, the strangest company I've ever had to work for, had the pleasure to work for. It's kind of odd. There's about 100,000 people that work on the Microsoft campus, and it is really a campus. It's something like 100 buildings, all interconnected. You know, every team has its own little unique culture, cafeteria. We spend a lot of time kind of going between buildings and between meetings, meeting different product teams, working on, you know, alignment between those things. And on the office team, work very closely with the Windows team and the System Center team and those sorts of things. It's just kind of funny, the different attitudes that different products have and different cultures. The office team is kind of renowned, at least in the small, tiny world that is the Microsoft campus, as being the team that always ships on time, but can never guarantee a feature. And basically, the office team, for the longest time, I think for something like 20 years, we would ship every 3 years like clockwork. It was like a train. And as a developer, as a feature team owner, if you didn't get your feature onto that train at that time, you waited for the next 3 years, and you shipped that next train. Then compared to that with Windows, Windows was the total opposite. The Windows development approach for the longest time was, here are the features we're going to deliver. We can't give you a timeline of when we'll deliver them, but here are all the features that we're working on, and we're not going to ship until every one of those features is different. And so you can imagine the kind of tension when the Office team and the Windows team were working together quite a lot. They were kind of ship, 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 ship. And the Windows team were like, well, we'll ship when we ship, like when we're finished, when we're ready. So it's kind of interesting that those sorts of concepts play up. And now both teams are kind of coming together as we're moving both of these products to be more and more cloud-enabled, more and more cloud-ready. It's really shaking up both of those development timelines. Windows now has to get into this mode of being never finished. And the Windows team, that's the hardest thing for them to do, and you probably see it in some press articles and those sorts of things, interviews with the senior Windows leaders. They'll use terms like, Windows is never done, Windows 10 is just the beginning, we'll keep shipping features on Windows 10. And it doesn't sound too dramatic, but it's a huge mind shift for the 10,000 engineers that have all been shipping a feature, a very fixed, closed scope every release. And on the Office team, we talk more about shipping every month and teams being able to ship by themselves without having to rely on other teams and breaking up that huge ship train into these little ripples of features. Not a big deal when you have 5 developers, but when you have 5,000 developers, of course Office, we're twice as productive as the Windows guys, when you have 5,000 developers, it's a big difference when everyone is shipping their own features on their own schedule, and being able to just kind of wrangle that all together in the one place is quite a challenge. And so we use tools like the roadmap. If you've seen roadmap.office.com, that's actually the tool we use internally to track everything as well, even though it's a public website. My morning consists of reading the blog to see if any of my coworkers have shocked me with a feature that they hadn't told me about yet, and somehow managed to release it. So before we get started, and while people continue to wandering in, I'll just go through some housekeeping slides. Join the Office 365 network. Anyone a member of the Office 365 network? A few people, great. Big discussion, there's about 50,000 people of IT professionals around the world, Microsoft staff, all on the Office 365 network. I think it's one of the largest Yammer networks in the world. We have a bunch of topics essentially at the end of every feature, when a team ships a new feature, we actually go on Yammer for a live Q&A with those features as well. So it's a great place to learn from the Microsoft engineering teams, as well as learn from your peers that may be doing similar deployments as well. Happy hour tonight, 7 p.m. till 8:30 in the community lounge, which is in the exhibition hall. Come and join us, free drinks. Don't really think I need to push that anymore. And so yeah, love to see you there. Let's get started. So we'll start kind of, and we'll get into the technical stuff eventually, but I want to start with this idea of kind of the magic of software and what it's really done to transform the desktop over this the last few years. I mean, you can think about software as like these, the world is being eaten by software, we hear a lot of people say, and kind of no industry now, no human endeavor has been untouched by software. Even the desk is totally unrecognizable from what it was 30 years ago, which you can see in this animated GIF. Desktop publishing, this kind of idea is kind of, it's a very archaic term as we think about it now, but that's still part of the core value of personal computing. It's allowing anyone to create, publish this high quality documents. You know, it's a phenomenal leap forward in just information dissemination. We haven't had kind of this sort of technology impact and since the invention of the Gutenberg press in the 14th century that really democratized reading and literacy to all of Europe. And then of course there's information discovery. You know, the internet browsers and the PCs and the clouds that run them really democratize access to information. Now anyone can get access to information anywhere in the world. And throughout this time, like us as IT professionals that are supposed to manage this desktop computing environment, this end user computing environment, our worlds are kind of totally changed now. It's not just about the PC anymore. Now we're managing people's calendars, we're managing people's phones, we're managing people's books. Everything they do now is tied up in this end user computing technology that we're responsible for keeping secure. And you know, there's been various kind of waves of this technology. It hasn't really happened overnight. It looks kind of crazy now when you see it over 30 years and it's kind of snuck up on us bit and bit. But at Microsoft, we really think of this as these three key waves of technology that have really changed how we do this. We kind of characterize these waves of technology by kind of the computing paradigms of the time. The 60s, this mainframe era, this pre-Microsoft era, if you like. But the whole notion, the whole paradigm there was it was one computer, many users. And then the rise of the personal computer, really one computer per user. And that was a huge change. And it started in the 80s, probably didn't really finish until the mid-2000s, or even the late 2000s. And I remember in education, in high schools, there was a big push, even in Australia, having one laptop per child and democratizing access to technology that way. But of course, the mainframes didn't go away. That workload of one computer for many users didn't just disappear because this new kid on the block came in. Those mainframes really adopted the best of breed of those PC architectures. They became servers. They propagated and taking on more and more of those mainframe workloads. I'm sure someone in this room still has a couple of mainframes running in the background. Show of hands. Anyone? Two mainframes in this room. Wow. But of course, everyone's got servers, right? How many people have servers? Anyone not have any servers? Haven't had a presentation where someone is, is that one? No servers? Not on site. Near enough. Yeah, that's kind of that new wave, right? Of the mainframes evolved to servers. And then the 2000s, this mobility era, where all of a sudden it's no longer about one computer per user. It's about several computers per user. All of a sudden, the humble IT team that was managing, you know, was worried about managing just as many PC assets as we had people, all of a sudden, and almost overnight, that number doubled as we started managing mobile phones, and then tripled as we added in mobile devices, and now even quadrupled as people have their choose-your-own-device, bring-your-own-device, laptops, PCs, and all these other assets. Of course, our IT teams haven't doubled and quadrupled over that same time. We're still trying to do the same amount of stuff with a vastly expanded scope of what end-user computing really means. That's really the mobility era. And you know, honestly, we're approaching the end of that mobility era, in my opinion. I think we're kind of the race has run as far as mobility. It started in the 2000s. We've done a lot there. The reason I think it's kind of at the end of this the cycle is I'm just not that interested in mobile phones anymore. I don't know if anyone else is. The last exciting phone that I was really excited about was probably the Nokia 1020 with a 40 megapixel camera. That was many years ago now. Phones have kind of started to really consolidate. They're starting to look the same. They're kind of conforming. And that's kind of the tail end, the sunset of this mobile era. And we'll talk a little bit at the end of what the era that we think is coming next around this. But really, that was several computers per user, several personal computing devices. And of course, the servers didn't go away, right? The servers evolved first through virtualization and economy of scale, and then to this notion of cloud computing. And the PCs didn't go away either. The desktop PCs stayed, became more portable, became laptops, became tablets, and those sorts of things. And so this is kind of the wave of technology, these eras of computing that we see. And this is an important point, because as we think about something like Windows and Office that have up to 10-year support life cycles, we really have to look out far ahead of saying, it's not just about what the environment looks like today, but it's about what the environment looks like when we finally decommission that piece of software in 10 years' time. We have to continue supporting that software that entire time. And if the industry shifts fast and we don't anticipate those shifts, we're left with a product that just doesn't meet the kind of needs of the users. So Office, our consistent productivity experience at Microsoft, you know, this is something, and everyone needs a mission statement, especially when you have thousands of engineers, but around empowering every person, every organization to achieve more. That's really the focus of Office. I like to put it a little bit differently. You pay us money, we make you better at your job. The rest is just a sales transaction of how much we can convince you you're better at your job and how much you want to pay us. But really, that's the promise, right? There's no other economic transaction there, that if Office isn't making you better at your job, if Office isn't making you do more out of your time, then we're not doing it. You're not going to pay for it. This is a tool that we make money from. We like making money from it. It's not ad-funded or anything like that. Our user is the customer when it comes to Office. And really, through things like personal productivity, desktop productivity, now expanding out to organizational productivity, the ability to take teams of people and help those teams of people be more creative is something that we're really investing in. And of course, leveraging the power of the cloud. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific things we're doing in Office to improve that as well. You know, Windows 10 is on a similar journey, and just like Office is kind of that one consistent productivity experience across all your devices, whether you're using a Mac, a PC, an Android phone, an iPhone, a tablet, whatever you're using, you know, Office available on all those devices. Windows 10 is almost the flip side. It's one platform that's available on any type of device, whether it's a small device, a large device, a phone, a tablet, an Internet of Thing, which is just a fancy name, way to say placeholder of something that may or may not connect to the internet one day, but we don't know what it looks like yet. All of these things are kind of powered by Windows 10, and it's been quite a journey to kind of converge all of these platforms together from the Xbox 360. And if you think back to the Xbox, the original Xbox, not the Xbox One, the Xbox One before the one before the 360 was the one. Anyway, Xbox was based on Windows. It was a PC at the time. It was running a very cut down or weird version of Windows Media Center. The original name for Xbox was the Direct Xbox. It was built using those Windows graphics libraries that powered that. And then, of course, the Xbox 360 came running on a G5 processing chip, made famous by Apple. In the Apple PowerMax of the time, we took that processor from IBM and built it into the 360. And of course, that meant we had to have a whole different Windows platform to run on that whole different architecture, but still based on Windows. It's still backwards compatible. We took our virtual PC team, actually. The virtual PC team went to work for Xbox rather than Hyper-V, which is kind of an interesting quirk of history at Microsoft. But the virtual PC team that used to do the Mac virtualization of Windows on Power PowerPC, PowerBooks, or whatever they called Macs back in the day, went to work on the Xbox 360 to port applications and games from Xbox One-ish to the Xbox 360. Fast forward to Xbox One, it's now a fully-fledged Windows 10 platform again. Same kernel as Windows 8. And likewise, Windows phones being on a bit of a meandering journey through Windows, through Windows APIs, through Windows kernels, now to the latest Windows phone, which is very much just a Windows device. And that's important as we think about how that looks in this mobile-first world as well. Mobile-first, a term that we love to throw around a lot. Not much to say about mobile-first. We're going to focus most of this talk on the desktop. I think mobile-first is kind of interesting. It's not at the exclusion of the desktop. We still have all of our desktops, but it opens up really interesting scenarios. And I think for the Windows context specifically, something that we're really curious about is continuum. This notion that you can have a phone that, because it's just Windows, it has peripheral support, it has a Bluetooth stack, it understands keyboards, it understands mice, uses a universal app platform, that you can actually scale up to run these devices. Your modern mobile phone has an 8-core processor in it, has 8 gigs of RAM, has 128 gigs of storage. This thing is like a PC by any other name, except it fits in your pocket, with Office apps, with peripheral support. Being able to plug it in and sort of scale up, essentially have a responsive design of an entire operating system to go from a mobile phone all the way to a desktop, is a really interesting scenario. And this is one I think may not be for your core office workers, your core information workers, but as you think about how you evolve field workers, engineers, doctors, nurses, truck drivers, police, however it is, this kind of computing paradigm becomes more and more interesting. In the UK, the Cambridgeshire police are using this, and you can imagine the Bill, the Bobbies with their funny hats, chasing after criminals with their batons, no guns. But they use Windows phones, Microsoft bands, and they essentially track everything through their smart readers. They know how far the police have run every day after chasing vandals and those sorts of things. And they can get back into the office, plug in their mobile phone, write up any reports, use the photos they've already taken on their mobile phone when they're investigating certain things. And it becomes a really interesting scenario now that they can take their device wherever they go. They can take their computing environment wherever they go. Raises some interesting questions, though, especially if you're the end user computing person responsible. Now, all of a sudden, you have this mobile phone that's doing everything that a PC is doing. Where are the security boundaries? Where are the update boundaries? How do you want to start to manage that device? And because Windows Phone is now just Windows, we can also use this notion of Windows Update for Business, the ability to actually hold back and manage rollouts of new features. If you've ever been burnt by an iPhone rollout of moving to iOS 9 and introducing all sorts of interesting new quirks, it's one thing to just rely on the carrier to decide when you need an update and when that update's going to be pushed out to your PC. But as soon as you take that mobile phone and it's no longer just a personal device, now it's a piece of organizational technology, it's important to start to exert some ownership over how you'll actually manage those updates and how you'll deploy those updates as well. And so with Windows Phone now, this notion of Windows Update for Business is pretty key. Just a high level, here's a shopping list in case you're interested. To get those sorts of scenarios, there's really three technologies that we plug together. EMS, the Enterprise Mobility Suite, that allows us to manage those mobile devices outside of the network, off the domain, to be able to manage their access to corporate resources, push certain apps, push certain settings, push features like BitLocker out to those devices. Office 365, Office 365 is our cloud solution. Really, we think more and more of Office 365, not just as a cloud solution, but a solution for scenarios where you have more devices than users. If you have more users than devices, it still makes more sense just to look at the traditional versions of Office. And of course, Windows Enterprise. Windows, Office, and Enterprise Mobility Suite, those are the three things that kind of make up those mobile solutions. But keyboard and mouse, still the input tools of choice. I think Word on iPad is amazing. I think that's a fantastic product. I've even tried typing up a full document using a tablet before. The greatest word processing applications on a tablet pale in comparison to something that has a keyboard and mouse. The sort of dexterity that you can get and manipulating data, manipulating numbers with a keyboard and mouse, a second to none. There's no other better situation for those core information workers. And I don't ever see a world where this will go away. I think as we see more and more technologies enter the marketplace, more and more user interface types, speech, text, ink, gestures, you know, maybe thought bubbles or whatever it is, I think we'll still see the keyboard and mouse. We've seen the keyboard around since the early days of typesetting. It's been around for 500 years. Is it going to go away anytime soon? Probably not. The mouse has been around for 50 years. It gives you a level of accuracy and control that no other device can do. So we expect that to continue to be around as well. And so on this platform, the keyboard and mouse platform and Windows and the core Office applications, we're still doing a bunch of innovation. And really the focus is around being more productive. I'll talk about these five key areas here, and we can kind of jump into it and show you what these look like. Again, I mentioned at the start, I'm an Office guy, so most of my scenarios will talk about Office and how that kind of desktop version of Office makes you better. Windows 10, of course, is a great platform to run Office apps. That's my best pitch on Windows. This is Planner. Planner is really interesting. As we think about personal productivity, we've kind of got to this point of peak productivity. It's no longer just about throwing you tools and letting you be productive, because what we're seeing now is people can no longer be productive. There's too many tools, too many choices. Now we're sort of moving to this world, rather than just adding features, adding functionality, let's start recommending processes, let's start recommending methodologies, and let's start recommending really guided and prescriptive programs of how you can actually do particular tasks. And you'll see over the next few years this heavy investment from the Office team around things like Planner, this ability to do lightweight project management for everyone, democratizing project management so anyone can manage tasks, manage the tools that they work, report on those tasks, assign those tasks to others. It's my favorite thing to do. And really track all of these things as well. You can think of it like the cross between a MS Project site, a Kanban board. If anyone's Kanban, anyone use Kanban at all? It's kind of popular in developers. Kanban's like the Japanese art of post-it notes. It's essentially you put them up on a wall in to-do, doing, and done, and you assign people tasks. It's a pretty interesting way of getting things done. And really this, what you see here on the screen, is just kind of a digital Kanban board, so easy to track tasks, see who's assigned to what, and get reporting out of it as well. The other one on the sleeper hit is OneNote. Who's using OneNote? Yeah, lots of people. Now. It's taken us 12 years. Where were you guys 12 years ago? but OneNote's kind of been this best kept secret in Office for quite some time. It was almost an application that way ahead of its time. It launched with the tablet PC in 2003, back when everyone thought tablet PCs were a joke. But really, this notion of OneNote is kind of this unstructured data, this paper replacement. You know, as interesting as paper is, it's tied up in a format that's really not accessible anywhere else. It's kind of dead tree technology. And so using these capabilities of OneNote, and what you see here is the ability of OneNote as an application to talk with the other applications and be context aware, knowing that you have calendar appointments and meetings coming up, being able to set up your meeting minutes with the attendees, with the agenda items and all those sorts of things. Make those notes, link it all together and very easily as a way, again, to be more productive out of your day just by using Office. And of course, working together. Office productivity is no longer just about what you can do, individual moments of brilliance in isolation. More and more, it's about how you work together and how together you build better ideas. This extends not just to Office applications, but also into hardware. And as we think about kind of key meeting scenarios and more people that are working in distributed teams around the country, around the state, or around the world, it's really hard to keep in touch. We used to call this at Microsoft the Technology 10. It was the first 10 minutes of a meeting where you all sat around trying to set up the video call or the conference bridge. And so the notion of these Surface hubs and the link room systems before them were really about transforming that experience. You could just walk into a room. The room could be meeting aware that you would automatically be logged in. The Surface hub essentially is an Exchange calendar item. You book it with the meeting room, and the TV knows that it's been booked. The TV knows or the TV, the monitor screen here, knows that it's part of that meeting. It knows when to kick off that meeting, so you can just walk into that meeting room, click a button, start that call straight away, and automatically dial in as well. And of course, this thing is just a PC. It's running Windows, it's running Office, it's running Skype for Business. You can manage it with System Center. You can manage it like a technology asset. It's not this extra parallel silo of technology that you have to manage inside of your organization. And of course, meetings, the other thing that we do a lot is collaborate on documents, whether that's Outlook attachments or share documents with groups of people. And some examples of kind of how, you know, that looks today in Office 2016. The notion of sharing. You know, you can share these options very easily, or you can click you can go into Outlook here, and this is modern attachments. And just by clicking attachments, this is essentially a feature called modern attachments. We're using this notion of roaming user settings to be aware of all the documents you had recently opened. Your MRD, your most recently used document list, it's been around in Word and Excel since Office 97. It's not really a new feature. What's new here is being able to share that information across applications to make that workflow a lot more simple. Now you don't have to go and find where you saved that document, find the right document you're working on. Outlook knows which document you had open last inside of Word. In terms of sharing documents, you know, it was very easy for users to understand sharing documents in SharePoint. It was kind of in the name. And it was a URL. People fundamentally understand that I can share a URL with other people. Other people can click that URL and see it. And so very, you know, a lot of sharing when people were very good and very familiar with using SharePoint. But when it came to Office, we kind of had a different experience. And so we focused on making that sharing in Office much more visible. Essentially popping that, you can see it in the top right, this share option. And very quickly, you can see the permissions, who owns the document, who's working on the document, whether they're in that document in real time. We're popping up those features, making them much more front and center to make it easier. And just by adding a name here, Office is taking the work out of assigning the right permissions to that user behind the scenes, making sure that they have edit permissions or read permissions on that SharePoint document library, on that OneDrive site, sending them an email to notify them that they now have that document. All very easy, just from within the Office interface. And that sort of thing, you know, allows us to open up interesting new capabilities as well. What I want to show you here is co-authoring. And this notion of co-authoring, if you subscribe to Jean-Paul Sartre's view of the world, famous French philosopher, hell is other people. This is probably the worst feature in the world for you. But essentially, it's kind of a nice feature here that you can actually co-author inside of the Office applications. Now, behind the scenes, what's going on here is this is all based on features that we introduced in Office 2007, where we changed the Office file format to this binary, this XML-based file format rather than the binary blob. The binary file format for Office, essentially what that was it was serialized memory. Basically, Office has been around so long, the old way of saving a document was just to take whatever was in memory and shove it down to storage, and that became your .doc and those sorts of things. If you want to reopen that document, you open the document from memory, from storage, and you just shove that blob straight back into memory, and away you go. Office knew how to open that document. Pretty good, pretty fast when you had storage-constrained, processor-constrained devices. The problem with that, though, is it's a horrible security story. Being able to share a document like that and just dump whatever's in that memory stream back into RAM essentially open up all sorts of nasty situations. And so as processes sped up, we were able to do more things around kind of a nodal document format, this XML-based document format that is essentially a tree of document items. And what you see here when co-authoring is what's actually happening is multiple people are just working on different nodes inside of that document format. And so Office can share not the whole document back and forth across the network, but it's just sharing that node that got updated. So it's highly performant. And it's taken us many years to build this feature. We could have rolled this feature out earlier. But really, we were waiting for the market to catch up. We're waiting for enough people to be using these new file formats, these XML-based file formats, before this feature could really shine. This is a feature you just could never do with those binary approaches. Okay, for the people that were here for cloud, let's talk a little bit about, you know, what the cloud means here as well. And I think some of the most interesting things in Office and Windows are really around how we're starting to use more and more machine learning, intelligent insights, and some predictive analytics. Cortana is an interesting example. Who's heard of Cortana before? Yeah, everyone's heard of Cortana. Cortana is really interesting, and it's really interesting for me when we think about tools like Tellme. Tellme is this new capability inside of Office that you can just use natural language search. You can actually query the Office interface to say insert or add graph. You can type in add graph. Now in Office, in Excel, that command is insert chart. The notion of Tellme is it's smart enough to actually understand that even though you said add graph, you actually meant insert chart. And it can translate for you and give you that functionality back. Really interesting feature by itself, but you can imagine the kind of powers of that sort of natural language interface if you could couple that with some sort of Windows-based platform that would be able to maybe recognize speech. All of a sudden there, this notion of being able to talk to an interface, to build a document through just voice recognition and those sorts of things becomes a lot more interesting. Not announcing any features now, but you can use your imagination of what Cortana and Tellme together could really enable in the future of how we're looking at those sorts of features together. Similar with Power BI. Power BI has a really interesting feature around Power Q&A. Anyone use this feature? Again, it's a natural language search feature inside of Power BI. You can actually ask a question in an English sentence to say, show me the number of issue logs coming from this branch office. And Power BI will actually do the pivot for you. It'll find that data and return you that result. Really interesting by itself. Really fascinating when you start to tie that and the sorts of power that things like Cortana could do. You can imagine now a watch that you can ask things of and you can return that data back. All of a sudden, you can actually start to think about business intelligence on a wearable device rather than requiring a massive screen with a spreadsheet and thousands of rows and those sorts of things. So this is just some of that technology that is starting to bubble through and we're laying the foundation for in Windows and Office. And of course, Delve, the Office Graph, we've had a bunch of sessions there. I don't think I'll labor the point too much about Delve, but it's really fascinating what Delve can kind of enable now. You know, as you think about it, Delve is kind of this first lens into what we call the Office Graph. Behind the scenes in Office 365, we're essentially assembling a digital approximation of all of the meetings you attend, all of the emails you send, all of the instant messaging conversations you have, all the documents you work on, and all those sorts of things. And that digital approximation is really interesting. You can do a bunch of things with a digital approximation like that. Cortana can tell you you're running late for a meeting. Pretty simple. Over time, that digital approximation, the power of machine learning, essentially at the end of the day, is just statistical analysis. And the nice thing about statistical analysis is you can start to do statistical simulations. And so the next step in this kind of evolution of technology, this evolution of machine learning, becomes that statistical simulation, those statistical recommendations of what you should do next. Delve is just a very simple example of this. It's showing you the documents that you should be reading. These are the documents, not that you are reading, not the documents that you have, not the documents you are working on, but based on who you are, the people you work with, the tools you use, the meetings you go to, the emails you send, these are the documents that are most important to you. It's a search engine that you don't have to type anything into. And all of this, of course, is restricted and managed, and it's all corporate restricted policy data that you can set up, and you can essentially set the rules and the scope of what these sorts of things can do. So this is really interesting. I'm kind of waiting for the day where my digital self will be good enough that it can go to meetings for me instead. It can respond to emails for me. It can tell me which meetings I can go to, which meetings I should decline, which documents I should read, which things I should type in the document, which days I should go to work, and which days I should just stay home and let the computer take over. So those are kind of the interesting things that we're just starting to see in this notion of machine learning. Similar, you know, I think this is perhaps, you know, more scary for a lot of people that have been looking at machine learning over the years. Machine learning, there's kind of, and I used to study cognitive science at the University of Queensland, and back in the day, we always used to say things like, artificial intelligence, it's never going to understand human communication. Artificial intelligence is never going to understand design. Artificial intelligence, it's just not going to get those creative human things. Turns out that's entirely false, right? It's just like computers will never play chess. Creative is very much an algorithm just like anything else. And what you see in Sway is this notion of using the technology, training an algorithm to actually understand patterns, understand colors, understand color palettes, and recommend to the user these sorts of things. It's really the death of WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get. I said earlier, we in a meeting yesterday, in our presentation yesterday, that we've reached peak creative skill. Our users now are actually, we have tools that are more powerful that allow users to be as creative as they can be. And now the problem, the real bottleneck now, is our users just aren't very creative. And so being able to outsource that, being able to offset that, rather than spend hours striving over that document, what that document should look like, you know, let an algorithm do it. Let an algorithm work out which colors, which fonts make sense. And this is really important because we've moved away from this world that a document lives and dies in this paper format. You know, Word, when you open Word, you still see this A4 document. And the reality is that document you're typing in Word will probably never ever see a piece of A4 paper. It will never get printed. It's born digital, gets created digital, gets shared digital. Even gets archived and destroyed in a digital fashion now. It may never ever see a printer. But we're still building documents as if they were meant for a printer. With more and more devices, more and more screen sizes, you're essentially in this world now that you're building for A4, but someone may be looking at it at a 4-inch screen or a 5-inch screen or a 200-inch screen or a tablet or anything in between. And so this notion of having machine learning take over in some of these creative assets aspects also allows us to use at read time rather than design time the output of what that document will look like. It brings this responsive notion to documents. We can essentially let machine learning take over here and generate a document that looks great on a 4-inch screen at the moment that I click that document and open it up. A similar user can click that same document on a different size screen and get a different reading experience optimized for the devices they're on. That's something that if you had to do yourself, you're essentially building 5 different devices and you have to predict all the various permutations of devices your users may be looking at content on. Machine learning can take over that, and that's a really interesting thing that you start seeing with Sway, and you actually see with technologies like Morph and Designer, the technologies we incubated into Sway, now coming into things like PowerPoint, and over time, Word and Excel as well. So that's pretty much the wrap-up of kind of user-level features. I want to switch gears here and talk more about kind of security, compliance, and management, and how we look at managing these particular technologies. Anyone security person in the room before I start making jokes about security people? Okay, good. seems like these days there's more movies about information security than there are stories about information security in reputable technical press. But the reality is, the model has changed, and I think this was talked about in the keynote, this notion of evolving from script kiddies and simple I love you viruses to organized crime, stealing credit cards, stealing identities, to now this notion of entirely nation states getting in on this hacking game, whether it's activists, whether it's terrorist groups, or whether it's legitimate governments. Everyone now is getting a piece of this kind of IP theft at whole scale levels. And so the threats have really changed. The things that you do to protect against malicious preteen script kiddies is very different to what you look at a well-funded, well-equipped nation state, you know, first world, world power, is also involved in trying to hack into your information network. This picture here is an example of one of our cybersecurity response centers. This particular one is over in Redmond in the outskirts of Seattle. The thing I love about this photo as well is that these are real people. This is a real network operations center. The photo is entirely staged. the reason, and you see that really expensive touch screen in the background there with the fancy map looking at attacks. And of course, it looks like a really important piece of data, but no one is looking at it. Everyone's checking email instead. Anyway, People love network operations centers. You have to have big screens with maps on them in network operations centers. You just can't get funding to build any sort of operations center unless you have a real-time map showing stuff. But really, the things to protect yourself in these sorts of environments, passwords, horribly weak and inefficient security mechanism. And Windows is really investing in evolving beyond passwords, not just something you know, but something you have, coupled with something you are, coupled with something you know, is really that level of protection that people need now. Protecting corporate identities as well off the PCs, we're seeing an incredible number of new types of attacks of being able to harvest corporate credentials off machines and attack that way. And so this notion of credential guard we're introducing in Windows 10 really encrypts and protects corporate credentials on the device itself, tying them to the TPM chip, hashing those credentials, and making sure that they can't be used on a different device, harvested off one device, and replicated on another. Sensitive corporate data, we'll talk about enterprise data protection as well. This is this notion of being able to start to selectively secure content on a machine that you may not totally own. More and more now we see these choose your own device, bring your own device, dual use devices coming into the organization, whether it's phones, whether it's tablets, or entire PCs. And so enterprise data protection gives us the ability to still encrypt or semi-encrypt some of that machine, start to manage some of the content on that machine, but still leave the user the flexibility to run all the Angry Birds and Instagram and Snapchat and Tinders that they may want to run. And then, of course, choosing the software that you want to run on as well is important. All of this technology that we build into Windows is great, but if the attacks come even into the firmware, into the BIOS or UEFI layer, there's not much we can do in the operating system layer to defend against those sorts of attacks. And so things like secure boot and device guard actually protect against those types of attacks as well. When we think about securing the hardware itself, there's a couple of different threats, and these are some new threats that we've seen over the last few years, and the sorts of threats that we expect to get more and more prominent as well. Simple things like just really breaking the hardware integrity itself. Malware that gets involved affects the boot record, the BIOS, those sorts of things before the system starts. And we use things like UEFI, secure boot, to protect against those sorts of capabilities. Things that attack the integrity of the actual security layer itself, impact the TPM, attacks directly on the TPM chip of the device rather than the software running on that device is something that's getting more and more important as well. And so building more tamper-proof TPM chips into PCs, into OEM PCs is something that we're really focusing on as well. Admin-level escalation. I hypothesize, and I put it to you guys, that we're slowly losing the battle of stopping users from being admins, local admins on their own PC. Who agrees with me? Show of hands, okay. Who's still doing it but knows they're losing the fight? Anyone? Yeah, okay, yeah. So it's not that yet, but it's coming, right? We can all envisage a day where every user is gonna be a local admin, and we are at the mercy of what that admin will do on that experience. And so now, admin permissions aren't enough, so we're looking at virtualizing the admin privilege escalations inside of the application as well, treating Windows processes as their own virtual bubble that not even local administrators can start to impact if they're running critical security use cases inside of that experience as well. And of course, biometric sensors, passwords, PINs, multi-factor authentication, stronger and stronger levels of biometric authentication, multi-factor authentication, just seem like the only way out right now. And as a security professional, there's all sorts of hoops you can make your users jump through before you let them log into a device. You know, at Microsoft, we are big proponents of this. We have passwords, PINs, and phone factors. Essentially, if I want to log into a phone for the first time, my phone actually rings. I have to enter in my PIN number into a phone number using the phone factor technology as well. In more secure environments, at Microsoft, if you want to use particular systems, generate keys, check in code, we do things like closed campus rules. You need to be at a particular location, you can't be logged into multiple locations, and it's linked up that if you've signed in on a particular PC in Seattle, that will deny all sign-in requests that are coming in from China or coming in from some other location and those sorts of things. So being able to start to geographically bound security checks is really that next generation of password and password security. So as we think about information protection, who's using BitLocker today? Excellent, yeah. And BitLocker's come a long way from, you know, technology that was a very exclusive part of Windows Vista that no one used to being really the default in Windows 7. And now with Windows 10, we've done a bunch of enhancements to just continue to enforce that data at risk. With the modern solid-state drive, encryption is essentially a no-loss game. A solid-state drive, by default, actually randomly sprays bits all over that drive. And so essentially turning on BitLocker has no real performance impact on a solid-state drive. On a spinning disk and on a platter disk, you still have some performance implications. But it's come a long way in BitLocker. And now you can buy SSD drives that are essentially BitLocker aware. All it does, you plug in that SSD, and it just changes the random algorithm on that device itself. And then it's automatically BitLocker secured as well. Couple that with enterprise data protection. It's great to secure that entire device and that entire hard drive. But as we think about dual-use devices, we have to start to think about how we separate the corporate content from the personal content on that particular device. And that's where enterprise data protection comes in. This notion of being able to identify the corporate data, the stuff that comes from your email boxes, SharePoint sites, other sources, and being able to selectively encrypt and selectively secure that data, but not worry about the OneDrive content or any of that other things, is something that we're introducing in Windows 10 as well. This also has a really interesting use for data leakage protection as well. If you take a file from SharePoint, you store it in a hard drive, and you copy it from a USB drive, the ability to essentially track that chain of that document and secure that document along the way so that even if it is put on a USB drive, it is still encrypted and can be shared around the organization without problem, but can't be shared outside of the organization. It's something that we're really focusing on, this enterprise data protection technology as well. And of course, this is all based on this rights management services in Azure, the notion of having your keys, being able to selectively encrypt content and selectively encrypt documents is extremely important here as well. And this entire left to right defense in depth approach is how we look at now encryption. Not only do you protect the entire device, but then you look at selectively protecting the corporate device, the corporate data on that device. And then in addition, for highly sensitive documents, you can encrypt that again using rights management services as well as you move that document, that content around the organization. So another interesting technology that we're introducing in Windows 10 for the enterprise is something called the Windows Provable PC Health Service as well. This is something that we introduced in Windows 8. Essentially what this is this is a cloud service ping where it pings back to check whether that PC itself is in a known good state. And so the example here is I will try and connect to my email service. And my email service will say, before I send you any data, you need to validate to me that you're an actual good device in good standing. So essentially, it would check against this preventative PC health service to check the boot integrity. Has anything been messed with on that particular device? Is the boot layer secure? Is UEFI in place? Is anti-malware turned on and up to date? And I'll send you a good key. And then essentially that token will prove that you have the right access to those particular devices there as well. And so this approach here allows you to be sure of a device that connects from your network from outside of the network. Right? So if it's a bring your own device or something like that, you can actually have faith that this device is protected. We introduced this in the Windows 8 timeframe. It was really for consumer PCs. In this case, all it would do in a consumer PC, if we detected that you'd fail these checks, that you were an infected machine or something like that. Essentially, what we would do is send you an email to say, hey, you've got malware running on your computer. You need to clean it up ASAP. What we're introducing in Windows 10 is the ability for you to manage this through a mobile device management software through Intune for not only Windows PCs, but also phones and tablets that you bring into the organization as well. Okay, so staying up to date, a couple of things to think about here with Windows. You have a couple of deployment choices with how you deploy Windows. Wipe and load, this is my favorite. You wipe everything and you load on a new operating system. Who uses this one today? Everybody, right? Yeah. And we're introducing this new approach here around an in-place upgrade. And so this in-place upgrade essentially preserves all the data, all the settings, all the apps that you have installed on that particular device, and really just installs a new operating system on that device and restores all of those app data settings back onto the environment as well. Anyone use this approach? A couple of people as well? Okay. And that's an interesting approach. It really, honestly, an in-place upgrade still uses the same amount of time, the same amount as a wipe and load. You have less time relatively around loading back all the apps and those sorts of things, but it is still pretty much a 3.5 gig download, an in-place upgrade, and 40-minute install to get you back up to that. So provisioning is a new approach as well that we're introducing in Windows 10. Provisioning is essentially a modern OEM style setup. Now what we can do in Windows 10 is rather than format, reinstall, totally re-image every device that we get from our OEMs, we can actually use this provisioning kit to really apply a delta package to that particular device, and rather than completely reinstalling Windows and all the drivers associated with it, just applying this delta pack to that OEM image can turn it into a Windows Enterprise PC with all the corporate settings that you've set up and all the apps that you've set up as well. So in this approach, it's a really powerful approach to quickly get devices up and running. Maybe you have multiple different devices. Maybe your organization allows their staff to choose their own PCs, bring their own PCs, or you have a hardware list that has not just one standard laptop that everyone gets. Maybe you have 55, 10, 100 different types of devices, and rather than manage a particular image and a set of drivers for each one of those, you can just manage one of these provisioning packs, and that provisioning pack can install on the top of any of those particular devices, keep all the and keep all the drivers and all the OEM software installed as it is as well. So a couple of things to think about how we do upgrades in Windows 10. And this is a little bit different to how we've done it in the past. We're essentially rolling out these waves from North American summer, fall, and summer. But essentially in June, in July, we roll out that first Windows 10 release. We've just released our next Windows 10 release as well. And essentially for these, to move between 7 or 8 or 8.1, you're essentially doing an entire operating system swap. So either if you're doing in-place upgrade or wipe and load, you're doing a full 3.5 gig deployment. It takes 1 to 2 hours. It's what we call the colorful screen when you log in, which is basically you think the install's done, but Windows hasn't really done the install yet. It's just loaded enough to say, hey, while you're waiting, here's karaoke lines for you to sing along. And essentially that will happen if you're moving from 7, 8, 8.1 to 10. Unfortunately, it will also happen if you're moving from the summer Windows 10 version to the latest Windows 10 version, the TH2 version of Windows. That's essentially an operating system swap as well. So you need to be prepared for this 3 gig image, this 1 to 2 hour install as well. We don't think that's a good approach long term, and we really want to solve it. And in the best practices of Windows being never done, we're actually going to improve this model with a new servicing approach that we're introducing summer, which, you know, summer is a pretty vague term in Australia, but in Seattle it is very specific because there's only about 2 weeks of summer. So sometime in July, we'll introduce this feature of upgrade via servicing, which is essentially, if you're on Windows 10 and you're moving to a newer version of Windows 10, what you'll be able to do is just do this delta update of Windows 10 to get to that latest version. You won't need to see that colorful screen again. The image size will go from 3 gigs down to between 500 and a gig, depending on how many changes we introduce with each version. It'll be able to be done in place as well. So that's coming along, coming down the pipe, and it'll be available sometime in 2016. So, a couple of things to think about. Who's familiar with current branches, preview releases, current branch for business? A few people? Okay. We have a session tomorrow that will talk a lot more about this. But the other thing to think about, as you're looking at all of these release cadence and release trains, you can actually choose which one, and you may want to move from one to the other. If you started on a preview build, for instance, you may want to, you won't be able to upgrade to a current branch or a current branch for business build as well. Essentially, preview builds are ahead of the train in terms of build numbers, and the rule of thumb here with Windows is you can't go backwards. So if you're moving to CB, you can move to the next CB, no problem. And you can even move to the preview, no problem. But if you're on the long-term service branch, and if you're on the long-term service branch, you can move to any of those other newer builds. But if you're on CBB, you can't move back to LTSB, you can't move to the older version without a full reinstall of Windows, either an in-place upgrade or an OS swap. A couple things to think about here as we think about modernizing Windows as well. If you're changing from BIOS to UEFI, if you're changing the architecture approach that you're taking with Windows, if you're changing the disk layout, you're going to do a full reinstall. Pretty straightforward there as well. On the Windows Server side, as you're thinking about upgrading to Windows 10, make sure you're on Active Directory 2008 or above. Make sure you get the ADMX updates for the group policy settings. Check out the latest WSOS activation, and KMS are still all supported on Windows Server as well. And of course, from a software side, to make that upgrade easier, you have a bunch of options available to you through the desktop optimization pack, Dart, AppV updates, UEV, and with System Center 2012 Configuration Manager, Service Pack 1 and Service Pack 2 of System Center 2012 have updates to be branch aware for Windows 10 to essentially allow you to choose which version of Windows you want to deploy and make that a lot easier to deploy as well. I had one other thing I wanted to add to System Center. Let me just check my notes here as well. System Center 2012 R2 Configuration Manager, SP1 or SP2 for the updated Windows 10 settings there. So that's really like kind of the most productive experiences on the planet is coupling Windows and Office together. This is a model that is really designed to scale, and we're looking at this as being the de facto platform of business productivity for the next 10 years. We're making a bunch of investments from phones, tablets, PCs, and even to HoloLens devices and those sorts of things as well. So I mentioned at the start, what's next? You know, if we're approaching the end of the mobility era, what's next for technology? And we really, you know, categorize this as the ubiquitous era of computing. Now we're moving way beyond just several computers per user to this world of thousands of computers per user. Mobile phones evolve to wearables, evolving to implants, you know, every surface becoming a computing surface. The cost of silicon is essentially the cost of sand. It's all the intellectual property that turns that into processing chips and those sorts of things. So the cost is just dropping and dropping in terms of where you'll be able to embed PCs, where you'll be able to embed smart devices and silicon. And for the devices that you can't embed silicon, this notion of holographic computing, being able to map computing experiences and user interface experiences over a geographic map is essentially how we define this holographic layer of computing as well. And as clouds get smarter and smarter and become less about what you can do, the economy of scale, the size reduction, the size explosion and the cost reduction, they start to be smarter and smarter around statistical analysis and statistical modeling and statistical recommendations that can then translate into simple things like telling you you're late to meetings, some very complex things like giving you design advice on what colors you should pick in your presentation. And we're already seeing examples of this. You know, HoloLens is an example, just built into Windows 10, and the APIs for all of HoloLens are built into all Windows 10 devices today. And of course, Sway, this notion of taking computing and taking the design layer out of the hands of the human and relying on statistics and algorithmic models to recommend good-looking designs to users is just an example of how this technology is starting to evolve as well. So thanks for listening. Pretty simple calls to action here. Please deploy Windows in Office. Current branch for business. current branch for business for Windows 10 and Office 365 Pro Plus are the models we recommend for most businesses and most organizations. And let's face it, if you're at Ignite, CBB are the ones that you want. Gives you extra time to stabilize those versions, gives us extra time to stabilize those versions as well. And so you're getting a more rock solid experience when you're deploying the CBB builds of Windows and Office. And with that, thank you very much. Please complete your sessions. Cheers. If anyone has any questions that they want to bring up as well, so thank you very much.